That's the Gospel of Luke in chapter 16. Before we get into our study this morning, I'd ask if you would bow with me in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that you give to us through your Son. As recipients of the great grace found in Jesus, help us to be stewards of the ministry you have set us toward, which is of service and value in your kingdom. Help us see heaven more clearly. Help us live in a way that honors the life of your Son and glorifies you. Forgive us of our sins, and this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so we are in the text of Luke. We're going to be looking predominantly at the first half of chapter 16 this morning. We'll see how class percolates and how things kind of move forward. You remember from our look into the text on last Sunday, we looked at those series of lost and found instructionals, the parables of Jesus that are all grouped together here in the gospel, and they're trying to help us really see a kingdom principle planted in an earth principle. That's what parables do. They give us a relatable story, a relatable reality that God generally says this is kingdom focused. It may be present tense kingdom entrance ideas, getting into the kingdom. It may be concepts around the idea of God's kingdom. Or they may be focused later to once you're in the kingdom and how our labor, work, and love should look as stewards, servants, participants, sons, fellow or joint heirs. All those terms are used in conjunction with many of the parables. That shifts a little bit in this section of the text because there's going to be a couple more parables that will come before we get to the dramatic climax of the life of Christ upon the earth. But in that shifting period, Jesus is going to revert to his more oratory, direct instruction style at times, where he's going to drop the parables. He's going to shift to direct statements. Many of those direct statements will be, in the context of the audience, hard or difficult for them to understand. And right now, he's picking up a theme which is interesting in some ways because it doesn't match what we would expect to be in the context of the lives of a typical first century disciple. The reason I say that is because here's the question for you. If you were to describe the Christians who followed Jesus after the cross or the believers who followed Jesus before the cross, how would you describe their background, where they came from, and what they were like? What are some words that would come to mind if you were going to play the word cloud game and start putting those things together?
Poor.
Poor is one of them. Joe?
You bring up an interesting point. I've been a little bit obsessed with my study of sin. And when you mentioned Christian, if you'll have the term, before the cross, here's where the confusion is coming in my mind. Before the world was blessed with the, quote, second Adam, meaning that Jesus brought the potential for salvation to the world, well, before he came and gave his life, where was that salvation?
Okay, so that's a complex question, and I'll say that this, I specifically shift terms around the cross on purpose. I spoke of Christians, which comes from the Greek disciples who are later in our book of Acts, and that's Christ's ones or Messiah's ones is the idea of it. Before the cross, I said disciples, his followers. But it doesn't change the nature of your question. Because we get into the idea of the question, it says, where is salvation to be found in advance of the Messiah? And in the text, there's some answers to that question. Answer number one in the text is, it's still found in the seed of Jesus. They talk about it. The salvation is going to come through that reality. Jesus is the seed planted in Israel. And so Israel is the garden to where salvation will arrive. That picture is repeated in the Old Testament, but here's the caveat to it. Someone, and we see this happen, doesn't have to be a Jew, part of the physical boundaries of Israel, or a proselyte to be found right in the sight of God. What they have to do is whatever it is God asks of them. We see that happen with individuals who serve God in secondary capacities. And I say secondary in that the Bible text doesn't follow their life in detail. You find them before Israel is a nation, in a large space of the text that goes from Genesis to Joseph. Israel's not a nation at that point, and yet people can follow God. You find that externally around Jesus. And so salvation is found prior to the cross in obedience to God. The text of Hebrews chapter 10 describes the effectiveness or power of the blood of Christ as being sufficient to cover sins present tense forward, present tense past tense. And so the sacrifice of Jesus is sufficient for all sin. Obedience was expected before Christ. Obedience is expected after Christ. The seed of salvation is still Jesus. In the specifics, it's going to vary based on what covenant you might be under. Israel's salvation would be on the standard of the covenant of the law. And you could proselyte yourself to that law, and now you're accountable to that law. But you could still be saved outside of that Israelite specific covenant. Illustrations are God sending prophets to foreign nations and telling them to repent. Change your ways. Do what I want you to do. Stop doing what you're doing. Does that make sense in the sense of salvation? That's very general, and it doesn't deal with each individual case, but it covers the large umbrella. Is that what you were getting at?
Well, that's part of it. And maybe the confusion, if you have it, goes a little further back before the birth of Christ. Well, I ran upon an impasse when I tried to make some sense of the first Adam and the second Adam and the original sin and the inherited sin. I tried to look those up in my concordance.
Right. So some of those are theological ideas that are held in the space of what's called Calvinism or Reformed theology. That's the idea of inherited sin and some of those concepts. First Adam and Second Adam is Paul's wordplay regarding the work and birth of Jesus in contrast or connection to the life, death, spiritually and physically, of Adam, the beginning of mankind. And so Adam, who brings about sin because of his teamwork rebellion with Eve, is our first Adam. Jesus then is our second Adam, because also he's also teamwork obedience to engage in the work for reconciliation. Now that is where some people will also insert this poorly thought out, or maybe not always well explained idea of inherited sin. And they say that we are inheritors of the consequence of Adam's sin on a spiritual and personal level, which is different than saying death now exists because of Adam. It says we're accountable for Adam's sins. That's inherited sin. The Bible doesn't teach that. It says that you are accountable for your sins. Your parents, your fathers are accountable for their sins. And Jesus' blood is sufficient to cover all sins. There's more complications under that because you get individual strange branches of all these various theories that you kind of have to prune and snip to get back to the text. So again, that kind of brings us back to our core question, though, is how do we describe these people who follow Jesus? Some of them, after the cross, become Christians. We said poor. We'll also include, on the basis of Joe's commentary, sinners. I think that's probably a fair thing. What else might we add? Two or three other things.
Learned people that do, after the cross, learn of Jesus, and so they become Christian.
Yeah, the disciples become taught or instructed. And some of them become teachers. So they mature that way. A growing people. We could say powerless. The bulk of them had no real power. They are not only poor, they're outcasts. They're not the elite. As a general clump. So poor, outcast, sinners who grow to become teachers. And a lot of that's kind of weird for their culture. Because people don't leave their caste and just walk up to another one. So with that, when you start talking about people who have lots of money to a crowd that doesn't have money, how do they view that conversation? Is it familiar to them, and how is it going to be familiar to them?
Well, they kind of feel like, you don't know where we're coming from.
A bit of an outsider. Here's the thing to recognize, though. All these disciples, though they don't have possessions, they see what people with possessions do. They observe that audience. These are servants, slaves, laborers, field workers, ranch hands, shepherd servants, those who do the low jobs in society, fishermen. So in that way of seeing these stories, a good thing to remember is they're not listening to it from the visual standpoint of being the boss. They see these stories, and that helps us understand how they react to them, by the way. They see these stories as the laborer does. Because a boss and a laborer, they see the factory floor differently, right? The colloquial idea of the boss, when he sees the factory floor, he's up high and looking over it, right? But if you work on the factory, do you go up on the upper tiers and walk around and see everything? Not really. You go to your spot, you do your thing, you go home. And you interact with that small group around you, maybe. You know, in the physical context. So that's a way to understand and see how the message reacted in the cocktail of those individual lives maybe differently than it would in a different setting when it's read later. And both of those readings are important because that the audience does also include wealthy folks, but in this context, are the wealthy folks that Jesus interacts with followers or decriers, deniers? They're the deniers, right, Joe?
Yeah, I like that. Is that one of the reasons why Israel, Matthew got such a blowback from Israel because he was a tax collector?
It's definitely part of it. He's a tax collector that makes him wealthy, but he was also a compromiser with a foreign nation.
Right.
So those two things made all tax collectors seem to be the enemy. And in some cases, they straight up were. They were skimming a larger portion, setting their own tax rates. They had to give a certain amount of money back to the home office, if you will, but they could set their own margin. And if you let people have their own margin, how big does that margin get?
Bigger as time goes on.
It grows until the stream runs dry, right? And then they go, oh, I'll just bring it back just a little bit to set it at the biggest rate possible. Because you can see part of that by the conversation that Jesus has with tax collectors. Hey, if you've wronged anybody, fix it. And do your job with honor and integrity is the constant stream of the teaching of Christ or those roles. So again, going back into the text here and paying attention to what we see, there's now a dialogue of what goes on with God and physical things. Mammon is the word that's used in some translations. Money is an idea underneath it. But recognize two truths that we have to kind of sort out with that. Not a lot of folks had a lot of currency, money. In part because money in this culture had its own intrinsic value. It was worth something in and of itself because of whatever it was made out of. Not always equivalent to what it represented, much like our money, but it had a physical value to it. Our money is mostly cloth if it's physical money. It's not even really paper anymore. It's more like linen, the way that it's produced. And our coins, their intrinsic value is generally far below its stipulated value, right? Has that always been the case, though? You ever been digging through old quarters and you find one that's a little extra heavy? How do you feel when you find that extra heavy one? Like, well, this is a better one, right? And some of them are genuine silver. And you can still find some of those in circulation, not like you used to. So you can feel the difference. Now, here's the point. If we have a culture that doesn't have a lot of physical currency, when they start talking about wealth and mammon and worldly goods, are they really talking about money anymore if they don't have very much? Talking about whatever you have, right? And do you need a lot of stuff or a little stuff in order to be greedy?
But doesn't the manna thing, again, my concept of manna is anything physical or flesh.
Right, mammon is a broader term that we apply because it goes into possessions. And that's the point. You don't have to have a certain threshold to now have a concern about your idea about physical goods. By the way, you can have spiritual problems about physical things and have nothing. You can have problems about spiritual things and be Solomon, who by context had whatever he wanted. So whatever's being taught here leaves the space of it's for rich people, poor people, powerful or depowered or unpowerful, not powerful folks. And it goes into there's something kingdom space that we need to learn about the world in general. Let's read a little bit of the text before we get back into some more details. And we're going to read this larger section here, verses 1 all the way through verse 13 right now. And Gary, could you read verses 1 through 9? And then David in the back, if you could read verses 10 through 13 after that. So Gary's 1 through 9, David's 10 through 13 of chapter 16.
Now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and his manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my manager is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I will do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors and began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down and quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings.
Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not seen, you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of their own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
Right, and I want you to think about this for a second. This particular section of the text, this particular parable in general, for many, through 2,000 plus years, is a bit puzzling. Why is it a bit puzzling? Why do we look at this thing and go, what is Jesus telling us to do? Why do we have that question?
Well, it sounds like he's telling a man, use your worldly possessions to make friends with unjust people so they shall have a safety net.
Right. It sounds like it's a bit earthly. And some people say, is this dishonest? Like, is he literally telling people to, like, cut the debt in order to cover yourself in case you're going to get in trouble later? It's like, is he making basically a mob family level argument here? Something that's hard for us to read in translations is the way in which we're supposed to listen to a story. Do we listen to it as literal go-do? Or do we listen to it as, should you learn something from this? Maybe this is an object lesson that you should pay attention to. Maybe it's sarcasm. Is sarcasm hard to convey in text? It's hard to do in person and do it well without hurting people, right? But in text, like writing it out, you got to like put giant arrows and saying, I'm being sarcastic. Or if you're trying to be funny, and look, we all try to be funny. And most of the time, we're not as funny as we individually think we are. We think we're super comedic. And if people don't get our jokes, they're just not funny, right? That's what I tell myself. You might have a different solution. Roy?
Well, I think there's also a lesson that we get from what he's saying. Being trustworthy has more value than your goods or your money or your property or your possessions. Because if people trust you, it doesn't matter what you have, they're still going to trust you.
So this is my read of the text, and it connects a bit with what Roy is telling us here. Jesus isn't saying, behave in all instances, in all cases, like these managers did. Because pay attention to the audience, pay attention to what's going on. They all knew that this is what people did. This is how the powerful stayed in power. Jesus is also teaching at the same time, because we read this in the next few verses, speaking to an audience that loves money more than the kingdom. And the message of Luke, just like the rest of the Gospels, has had its accelerometer speeding up to some core events. And what's that big thing that's about to happen? Old law's about the end. Trial, arrest, and crucifixion of Jesus. That's about to take place. And so the kingdom they're familiar with is about to go away. And he's subtly reminding those who are paying attention, look, you'll do this to protect your hide. Why aren't you thinking about your soul? Like, that's a subtle undertext to what's going on here, because, verse 14, the Pharisees, who were lovers of what?
Money,
heard all these things, and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God." That's like your little, how do you interpret the last passage? It said, men totally think this is okay, but this is not okay. "The law and the prophets were until John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached, and everyone forces his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void." So you get like a short Luke explanation of what Jesus just declared in this next tidbit. So look, what you've been doing and how you normally justify your behavior isn't godly. And since the kingdom is going away that you're so attached to, maybe you should shift your priorities and think about, how do I get into the kingdom that's coming? That's the shift in the text that helps us appreciate and understand, does money, the love of money, the physical things matter like everybody often thinks they do? No, they don't. And know how we all agree that's the case? I got you a second, Joe. Think about this. Right now, your house burns down, but everybody's safe. What's the first thing that we all say? It's just a house, right? I don't have insurance. It's just a house. I worked out of home. That's where I made my money. It's just a house. And what do brethren do for one another at that moment? Okay, let's go clean it up. Let's go start up whatever needs to happen. That's the backdrop to our communal understanding that we all actually know money doesn't matter. Now, we don't always behave that way because we forget, we get prideful, we get ensnared. Joe?
You brought up an interesting point. As Jesus was about go to the cross, did the religious leaders, did they have a perception of that? Is that why they were trying to hang on to the old law concept where money, wealth was power? And they saw the coming of Jesus as one that was going to destroy that power base that they had.
So they don't seem to indicate having a good theological, like God's teaching knowledge of kingdom things, but they do see Jesus as a threat. They do see him as someone who's going to steal their influence. And they do find a lot of their efforts recorded in the text as being, we need to put him in the ground. They do want him dead. They don't know what that means, but they know that he is a distraction to maintaining their power for all the reasons that we might think that's the case. They don't seem to know that he is at all God's chosen, or at least acknowledge it. But early on, they wanted him to be their kind of king. They were willing to have him be their puppet, but not willing to have him be their king. Is another way to think about it. That's not the end of this section, though. That covers this parable and then an application. And then there's a whole lot that takes place from this point forward that are leaving that parable space we talked about before and go into direct instructions. One of them is recorded for us here as a single passage. And that's in verse 18. There it says this: "Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery." Does that seem to match the context above and below? It seems like, hey, what's that going on? That's a whole separate discussion about like textual stuff, and most of the texts actually have it right here. So here's two things to think about. One of these ways to read this, aside from the obvious plain application of the text, which makes sense, easy to understand, which we'll talk about in a second, is to think more about the culture of the first century and how this statement is going to be understood. In this space, if you are a woman who wants to follow Jesus and your husband refuses to let that happen, what's going to happen? Is that anything different than what happens today? It's going to be a problem, right? And in that culture, they had already normalized this. This is from approximately AD 72. This was found in one of the wadi, that's like the washed out spaces in the desert space near where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And that's a divorce decree for any old reason. And as is typical for this context, it's a divorce decree of a man putting away a woman because he wanted to. There's no clause or cause is necessary in the way that they interpreted that. Now, understand this. In that culture, there are other complications of divorce that we all share. Post-World War II, were there marriages that had to be sorted out because somebody died in war? And it took a long time to figure that stuff out? Absolutely did. They got married before. He went overseas. Took unknown amount of times. Some were declared deceased because there was no remains to be found. And for the most part, that stuff got sorted out. You know what happens in the first century too? That communities go to war and not everybody makes it back. That's a normalized thing. But here's the difference, especially in our current 21st century context. In the way in which communities and societies functioned, not the Bible teaching, but the cultures of the Bible is taught within, is that women had no means of support in most of those communities outside of a few options. They could enslave themselves. They could engage in prostitution, or they could beg for assistance from family. And the concept of begging for assistance from family is going to fit into a couple of spaces. Either it's going to be Boaz, Ruth level, biblical actual application of biblical text principles, or it's going to be, yeah, we'll give you a spot, but it ain't going to be much. And we got to figure out a way to remarry you so that you can go off and marry somebody else because we don't have the means to support you forever. That's all in this undergirding space. And so this teaching that Jesus gives about it is to an audience that is more accustomed to what we would consider no-fault divorce, but only male-driven no-fault divorce. And he's saying, no, it doesn't work that way. He's saying that in the remarriage, there are spiritual consequences. Now, in the context of the text, that also applies to our audience here, if applied to the kingdom level as well. Because that's what you do with a parable or a teaching principle. You take something you know in an earthly realm, and you switch it now to a spiritual realm. So if you're trying to be married to both the world and to God, what does that make you? Hypocrite who is an adulterer. You got to pick. So there's an application space where this known earthly principle that they all struggled with. And by the way, did Pharisees and Sadducees struggle with this? They straight up fought about it because they're like, hey, uh-uh. And so we don't like it so much. We actually use it to use as a tool to fight about our other theological differences. We fight about the resurrection by using marriage stories and divorce stories. stories. Which, by the way, if you start doing that, like today, if you start using marriage and divorce stories to try to define your theology, you're probably not going about things the right way. It didn't work well for them. Don't think you're better than they were. We're just the same. So maybe a different approach needs to be applied. And so now, go back to this text here. He said, choose the kingdom you want to be part of. Be willing to sell whatever it is to get into the right kingdom. But in essence, don't try to be part of both. And then he uses this well-understood countercultural teaching. Because on the backdrop of how they applied it was the reality that this is actually the understood truth from the text. And a lot of Israel culture outside of the Pharisees and the Sadducees argued in favor by their lifestyles that this is what they should be doing, especially in the poorer regions. Because there is very little financial incentive to divorce a person. Because you're still going to be poor. Except now you have half of the team to help. And so you can't go buy a laborer or two laborers to take up that labor that now ended in divorce.
One little phrase that kind of caught my attention in verse 9. I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth. So when it fails, it doesn't say if it fails. Yeah. When it fails, this is going to fail.
Yeah. Okay. There's no question that Jesus is foreshadowing the outcome here. And it's not limited to the destruction of the temple. It's not limited to the destruction of the old law system. It's general. Every nation falls. Right? That's the subtle undertruth to the prophecy that's contained in Daniel. Any other earthly nation is subjugated to the grand kingdom of Christ. Do we like that if our kingdom is number one? No. But if your kingdom is number 72, do you care as much if nations crumble? Shouldn't. Shouldn't care if you're number one either. Well, that's a picture that you're being shown here, that Jesus' kingdom is going to umbrella cover, stone crush all of this. Is there a biblical picture or idea that shows what happens to the earth? What's that? What's the image that God gives us through his writers?
Being burned with fire and destroyed.
Fire, melted. Sometimes it's also equated with the destruction that's connected to gnashing and wailing of teeth and those images there. It's not a new image, by the way, either. It's not just a Pauline John image, because it's all throughout the prophets. They talk about the same level of kind of destruction. That all of these things can be laid to waste. And if you want to tie one more tidbit of it to kind of connect all the dots, is remember what God says to mankind through Moses regarding his people. Can he rise up another nation if he wants to?
Yes.
Absolutely can. It's like, things don't function the way that we are comfortable with thinking that they do. Because God's power supersedes our senses. And this is the way that you can think about it. How many of you went through a period in your life where you locked the door before you went to bed? Like you just had to lock the door. Right? Especially depending on where you live, right? Do you guys live in houses that have windows? So did you lock the windows too? Which is tougher to keep someone out of, a door or a window? If you want in, locks don't mean a thing. Here's the illustration for you. We got locked out of our house and we had a locksmith come and get it. And this is my learning moment. The locksmith comes in and we had access to our garage because we had a garage door opener, but that door was locked because it had been locked. You know how he got into our house and how long it took him?
Well, 2 minutes.
Not even 2 minutes. No special tools. He grabbed a cordless drill out of his box and a drill bit, which I actually own the same drill bit in my toolbox next to him. And I had a drill charge up right there. Like that much time. Jingle, jingle, jingle. Here you go. 30 seconds.
What did he drill?
Drill up the lock.
The lock?
Yeah.
Did he put a key in there?
No need. The lock's gone now. I just went and got a new lock mechanism, put it back in. Doors are the same. 30 seconds. What we think is safety and security is almost always vanity. Now everyone's going to be like freaking out. I can't sleep at night because my house isn't secure. It's just as secure as it was the night before. But our view of the world might have changed a little bit.
You know, I used to have to give the locksmith all the time, and they can open the lock.
Oh, they can, and they're much quicker than I could. Yeah, they can do it, but then you're also paying for the time for them to do that versus the time to replace the lock with a $10 lock at Lowe's, which is what the mechanism inside those things actually costs, is about 10 bucks. So your math equation comes out. Do I pay him $100 to re-key the lock and pick it, or $35 for the service charge to be out and $10 for me to replace the lock? And so you know what the answer is in my world, which is the less dollar cost and solves the problem. Here's again where we come back to the biblical premise of these things. It's not that we can never be safe. It's an actuality that we can be safe. But safety isn't found in physical spaces. And that's a hard thing to accept at different points in our life. It's hard when you're young, when you think you're invulnerable and invincible. It's hard after your first real physical ailment, when you think, I'll never be well again. But Jesus is trying to teach us that real security and real safety and real concern and trust is found in Him. That's the big challenge point. Which leads us to our typical end of the conversation period type questions. So we're close to the closing bell of things. What else do you guys see here? Things you liked, didn't like, things that challenged you. What do you want to know more about? You can pick all one, some, or none in your way to talk through it if you've got something to bring to the table. Bobby? And then Bobby, go first. And Steve?
He's trying to get us to look at the old law and what it had to offer. And look at the new law that will get us into the kingdom and finally be saved if we stay there and be faithful.
Yeah, there's definitely a look for the kingdom level push to the text here. Steve?
Out of verse 10, I get that if you let the little things slide, you let the big things slide.
And that's important too. I think there's a level of, there's a sign that exists on old mining carts that they all had the same emblazoned. There's nothing more safe than a careful man. And that kind of fits the teaching space of this text, where if you make intentional, invested choices about what matters to you, that produces the outcomes you're looking for. If you're just kind of like, I'll just let it all go and not worry about it anymore, then that's exactly what happens too. There's a good balance there. Joe? You're making those choices to follow. The big message of the gospel is that Jesus' work was successful. That's the gospel kind of simplified to some degree. The request of the hearers, those who are listening, is that you submit yourself to that success and be obedient to him. That's it for our class right now. We'll pick up with this next week, beginning in verse 19. Thanks, everybody.